quite broadly anyway, but I want to move on and set, we have touched on this already, but I want to ask now about the panel's views on employment and skills specifically. And I kind of like to start with the leave side this time, I think. So, someone you want to go with that?
Well, as you've just heard me say, one person's job on this panel really is in the balance here. And that also goes for another 78 British MEPs and one British commissioner and some British bureaucrats. But I am convinced that they will all, we will all, be profitably redeployed to the bit of the economy that makes things and sells things. And I'll tell you why I am confident about our prospects post-EU. If I had to put it into one sentence, it's this. The EU is obsolete. It dates from an age when freight costs were high and refrigeration was expensive and regional trade blocs looked like the future. But that age has been left behind by technological advance. It's as easy for a company in Kent now to do business with a firm in New Zealand as with a firm just across the channel in Dunkirk. In fact, it's easier because the Kiwi company, unlike the French one, will be English-speaking, will be common law. If there's a dispute between the two parties, it'll be arbitrated according to legal norms that they both recognize. It'll have the same accountancy system, the same unwritten business practices. Very few of those things are true, despite decades of single market regulation across Europe. And that's why we need to think of the world into which our children are growing up. One of the things that has irked me in this campaign is hearing the Prime Minister and others on the Remain side saying, think of your children, as though the rest of us either don't have children or don't care about them. It's precisely because we have to think of the world as it's changing, no longer Eurocentric but global, that we need to think of how to exploit our advantages as a country linked by language and law, by habit and history, and by kinship and migration to every continent and archipelago. How bizarre, how extraordinary that after 9 years we don't have, because the EU doesn't have, a trade deal with India. We're the third biggest investor in India. India's the third biggest investor here. They own Jaguar, they own Tetley, you know. There are 1.4 million Brits of Indian origin. There is not a country in this part of the world better placed to enjoy untrammeled commerce with that rising giant. But, you know, it all has to go through Brussels, and nothing can be signed off until every last Italian textile worker and Polish farmer is happy with the deal. And that cannot be right for a merchant country like ours. I wouldn't mention this, except that I've been irked by all the talk of children, but slightly surprisingly, my wife and I are expecting another baby just after this referendum, 14 years after our first and 11 after our second. It was one of those pleasant surprises. And one of the many things I wish for that child is to grow up in an independent country that retains the right to hire and fire the people who pass its laws. My late father was prepared in 1943 to take up arms in order to defend our right to live under our own laws and our own people in our own sovereign parliament. I don't want his grandchildren to be disenfranchised of that part of their patrimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Daniel. A passionate man in every sense, apparently.
I am like a bull.
I'm going to try and stay on topic. It was very interesting what Dan said, but it wasn't much about jobs apart from his own job. I think that the first thing is it will be bad for jobs, and it will be bad for jobs in quite quickly, because what will happen if we vote to leave is there will be a sudden and abrupt change. It's not, as Dan says, that it will be a gradual process and nothing will happen until we actually leave. What will happen is that there will be almost immediately political turmoil. Cameron will have to resign. There will be a leadership election. As I said before, probably Boris becomes Prime Minister with Gove as Chancellor, maybe. then they will have to figure out actually what they want from their divorce deal with Europe. And they haven't figured it out because all of them have different ideas at the moment. So they have to work out. And the problem is that they have been making wild promises to the British people about how easy it will be to get a good deal with the EU when we leave. It reminds me a bit of what happened in Greece last year when Alexis Tsipras and Yanis Varoufakis came in as Prime Minister and Finance Minister of Greece. They had made wild promises that they couldn't possibly hope to deliver. They then got into a big fight with the EU. And one of their clever ideas was, well, we can blackmail the EU. We'll blackmail the Eurozone. If they don't agree to what we do, we'll basically blow ourselves up, and that will blow up the Eurozone too. Well, they quickly had to do a U-turn. And what interested me last week, actually I think it was even this week, was a column in The Times by Michael Gove, which came up with the same brilliant idea. It was, we will blackmail the EU, we will sit there vetoing everything that we can until finally the EU agrees to give us exactly what we want. Well, what I can tell you is that will guarantee the bloodiest of all possible divorces. And in that time, the pound will fall. You talk about the cost of living. The cost of living will go up because prices will go up. Businesses will retrench. They will sit on their hands until they know what the result is, what actually, and Dan Hannan's saying, well, it might be several years, not 2 years. He's saying maybe 3 or 4 years. My God, more uncertainty, years of uncertainty until it's dealt with. Consumers also will probably retrench. And what does that mean? That means the economy not growing very fast and in some cases possibly even shrinking, a new recession. Bad for jobs. Far from wages going up, wages would be flat or falling in those situations. So, bad for jobs, bad for prices, and bad for our security.
Okay, thanks, Hugo. Chris or John, somebody want to pick up on that? I specifically want to try and focus on jobs and employability and skill.
If the EU is such a fantastic place to be, why is it, as I said earlier, that you know, France youth unemployment is nearly 25%? Italy is 39%. Spain, I've looked up, is 45%. I go to Spain quite a lot. It's actually nearer 50%. If everything works so well, why is that the status quo for these countries? I mean, along with us and Germany, we make up 63% of the population of the EU, and three of those countries have got that kind of unemployment. It just doesn't make any sense. Roger Bootle, who's founder of Capital Economics, he actually thinks that leaving the EU would actually cut unemployment. And staying in is a risk to financial services in the City of London. Whether you like the city or not, we can't do without it. Other than the New York Stock Exchange, it's pretty much the biggest stock market on the planet. We're just hooking up with Germany and linking up with them so that New York doesn't buy the London Stock Exchange. We have such power to run our own ship here. Surely we don't need the restrictions that there are with almost doing anything at all in the EU.
Yep. That's it. Okay, thanks, Chris. Tobin or Tina, I don't mind which goes first.
Mine's very brief. So I agree unemployment will go up. I think that Europeans will leave. I'm imagining that they will go. They won't be able to work here. I don't know how over what time period. I don't think, particularly in some of the professions, doctors and nurses, I don't think we have got the right skill base here to fill those positions. So some of our fundamental services might be at risk there. From a Unicom point of view, from my business point of view, we employ European people. They are hardworking, reliable, and have a very, very high skill, which they bring over. And they make us, as a business, competitive in our market.
Okay, thanks. Tina?
I go to Australia quite a lot. I'm very fortunate. My daughter lives over in Australia. And it's interesting that I wish we were a bit more discerning in sort of the people who will be let into this country. They have very strict controls over it, and they're very select about if you've got a certain skill set. My daughter is looking, she's a teacher, so she's obviously much in demand. I wish sometimes that we could be a bit more discerning in sort of encouraging people to come here for the people that we want. Unfortunately, it's life in general, I know, but we get to all sorts, and I think some of the immigration that we've got, who are out of the EU, we will have a greater control on perhaps who comes into this country. And I think we should have a greater control on who comes into this country and be a lot more discerning and type. And then that you're coming into Britain, what can you contribute? If I wanted to move to Australia and at one stage we looked at this, you have to have, here's their criteria. If you meet this criteria, then we will consider you. We don't seem to have something like that at this moment in time. We're gradually leaning towards it, which I think will be a good thing. But I think something that there is a lot more planning to be done about the people who are coming into this country and the skill sets that they can bring. We need to be a bit more selfish on something that can actually help this country, not hinder it.
Cool. Chris, you want to make it?
Just a couple of points I forgot to mention. We're talking about unemployment. The EU has pretty much been responsible for demolishing our entire fishing industry. We've lost 115,000 jobs. There's almost no fishing at all. And in terms of protecting farming, the subsidy goes to the farmers before we pay Brussels. We don't pay it and ask for it back. So there's no reason why that needs to change at all. The support for farming should be there, if not as good or better than it already is.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Well, we'll come to Tobin, and you can address that point if you wish, Tobin, but the general point is about jobs and employability and skills.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we're going to keep, if we leave, I'm not sure we're going to keep that. I mean, all these promises are made about keeping the apricots, or they're not subsidies anymore, they're direct payments. But I very much doubt we're going to keep the Conservative Party. Long-term policy is to get rid of them. Labour Party got a vegan in charge of agriculture right now, so I mean, who knows?
That's not true, Toby. The Farms Minister now, George Eustace, who is a Conservative Minister, has made very clear that they will carry on.
Yeah, but look, from what I understand, long-term policy is to get rid of agricultural payments.
No. In fact, they could be a lot more generous, because at the moment we're paying $4.6 billion a year into the CAP. We're getting back $2.9 billion a year. Simple maths tells me that you could all be a lot better off.
Yeah, but the reason the reason we're doing that is our GDP per capita is higher than the rest of Europe, isn't it? So that's why we pay more in.
I'll tell you what, I think there will be a downside for farmers, which will be that we would have zero tariffs and cheaper food. But I think the flip side of that is that you would need what every other country in the world has, Japan, Canada, everyone except New Zealand, which is a level of direct support. And outside the CAP, if you took the amount that we're getting and you just did it in the cheapest way possible to administer, which is a direct acreage-based grant, regardless of land quality, regardless of land use, you'd get 90 quid an acre. Now, that's better than you get. And it would be ages, because we'd be outside the CAP.
Thank you for the speculative answer, but it's all speculation. We don't know. And I'm afraid I don't trust it.
Either, yeah.
But, I mean, I know where I'm going. I know the farming will be supportive. Anyway, okay. Going from...
Let's move on and address the question that we started with, which was employment skills and
employment skills in agriculture. We rely very much on the European, especially Eastern European labour force. I got through three British employees over 9 months. I took on a poll, and he was with me for ages. We really do heavily rely on the Eastern European. Unfortunately, there aren't the people around now who want to work, do manual labour and get involved with farming business. I was at this Brexit meeting the other day, organised by the NFU, and one farmer stood up saying how he had a grape harvest. He had his grape harvest to harvest, and he took on a number of local Brits to come pick it. By day two, they'd all gone. Next year, he went and got in a whole lot of Eastern Europeans. They stayed and did the job. So many, we rely so much on these people, and we don't know what's going to happen to them if we then come out of the EU. I rely on, for my shearing, I rely on Australian New Zealanders to come over and shear my sheep. Now, a few years ago, some foreign office official, I imagine, decided that they'd stop them coming in. And so the contractors had to do this mad bit of bartering with them to try and get the shearers in. I mean, who knows what regulations are going to be put up and barriers are going to be put up to workers coming in into this country. And we desperately need people to do the manual labour that, unfortunately, the local British population don't want to do.
Okay. Yeah. Isn't that theory, but that's the strongest case for leaving that you could have made.
The reason we're not able to take Australian and New Zealand nationals, or indeed others of Commonwealth origin, is because we've had to free up unlimited space for 500 million EU passport holders, regardless of their skills and qualifications.
But there's far more Europeans that want to do that work than
but the point is, if we had our own migration policy, we could take the people we want without having to take the people that we don't want.
Yeah, but
can I ask Dan a question here? Because people on your side, not all of them, but of the more sort of free market variety like you, often say that you'd like to have more people coming into the UK from the rest of the world. Last year, the net migration from the rest of the world, that is from outside the EU into Britain, was 190,000 people. How many would you like it to go up to?
Well, I mean, there is a practical limit to the amount of net inward migration that any country can take. It's probably round about where it is now. The total numbers are probably roughly, it wouldn't change very much.
But how can you then say that you actually want to welcome more of these people?
Well, the point is it's about control. If you want to make
but you'll be disingenuous to be saying that actually we'd like to take more Australians and Indians,
well,
etc., if you're actually saying that you don't want the numbers to go up at all.
I think in practice you would have fewer EU nationals, because at the moment we have to take all EU nationals pretty much regardless of what skills they offer, whether they've got any job to go to, what their background is. We could be far more discerning and pick the most qualified people, whether they're from the EU or not from the EU. We could have a system that recognised connection to this country, the English language, and the skills that they bring. At the moment, if you hold an EU passport, whatever your skills, whatever your qualifications...
But how many do you actually want, that 190,000, do you want that to go up or to stay the same? It's not quite clear to me.
The total net inward migration that we're getting now is about right for an economy of our size.
Oh, it's about right. So you don't want the net migration.
No,
what I want is
quality control. I want us to be in charge of roughly who comes in and roughly in what numbers.
No, as
long as we're in the EU, we do not control either thing.
That's good. I just wanted to clarify. So you're because many people on your side actually want to reduce the numbers, but you're quite happy with around.
My quarrel is not with the numbers. It's about the control.
That's
okay. Interesting debate. Let's throw it open to the audience, and we want to keep this short because we've got to translate these questions that are going to come from the audience. And remember, a quick show of hands. How many people in the audience are employers? Oh, a fair few. Okay. So we're debating employment skills and related issues. And who'd like to ask a question on that? Gentleman right in the middle there, as far away from the microphones as possible.
I run a business. It's a recruitment business. The one thing which I have never shied away from is change. Change creates fantastic opportunity. And a change of coming out of the EU, I relish. I've set up three businesses, sold two of them. I can't wait for another shot at something like that. The change of the market is absolutely fantastic. If we come out of the EU, I know that I will be faced with a series of governments who have to provide a mandate which us, the general public, can vote upon. And if they don't deliver what they say they're going to deliver, or if we don't like what they're delivering, we can throw them out. All I've heard so far from the Remain In campaign is fear and fright and what's going to happen to my business and what's going to happen to the world, the door's going to fall off. I bet you didn't see loads of the regulation coming down the train coming down the track that's hit us in the face, like the working time regulation and so on and so forth. What other things is the EU going to do over the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years that we don't know about now? Because they're things we cannot change and cannot affect, and we might not want to do them.
the question is about employment and skills. So what extent is your question aimed at that?
I'm sorry?
It's about employment and skills. So can you just compartmentalise your question in terms of how it relates to employment and skills?
Well, the point is, what is the EU going to do in terms of regulations for employment and skills next 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years' time?
Okay, fine.
What the EU is going to do,
fine,
what their strategy is, and where they're heading.
More questions, and then the panel can address all of those. Thank you. Who have we got? A gentleman down the end. Sorry, Andrea, I'm making you run around.
One of the panel mentioned earlier that financial services was 10% of the UK economy. Well, I think in Sevenoaks, for the people living in Sevenoaks, it's more like 50%. Everyday people on the train come down from London. They work in banking, fund management, lawyers, accountants, insurance. And they, in turn, support employment in the town in estate agents, car showrooms, restaurants, private schools like this school. So I'd like to ask specifically for the panel, what would be the effect on the financial services industry and the employment it creates of leaving or staying in the EU?
Okay. Thank you. Another question. Lady there, please, Kirsty.
Hello, I have a question for Chris Brown. He was talking before about 600 billion of red tape, of costs. I would like to have a breakdown of those costs. And also, I would like to know, those costs are against what kind of benefits or revenues? Also, when you talk about red tape, can you kind of specify what kind of red tape? I mean, I would like some details, because it doesn't mean anything, just as 600 billion pounds. I mean, it's just a bit too vague.
Okay, but these are general questions, and we were trying to ask questions about employment and skills. Somebody else? A gentleman at the very back there, sorry. We will address your question in a moment. We're coming on to some of those issues.
Thanks. This is a bit of a crossover question between the trade and employment. They're all linked, I think, as we all understand. So what, if any, retaliatory trade action do we anticipate the EU could take, and what impact would that have on skills and employment if we leave?
Okay. So some of the things that have been raised are, what are the plans of the EU over the next few years in terms of how it's going to develop and how it's going to grow and what will be the impact on business? I'm afraid I couldn't hear the gentleman at all there, so I don't know if Andrea can paraphrase what the gentleman there said. We have a question also about the numbers that Dan had, and we'll address that in a bit of a moment in the next section. So let's kind of look, first of all, if we go to the Remain side, what are the plans for the EU? We've talked a lot about the uncertainty of leaving. What's the certainty of staying, if you see what I mean?
Okay, can I just say one thing? Is that the EU has several different elements to it. The problem areas of the EU are the Eurozone and the Schengen area, and we're not in either of those. When Dan, I think it was, or maybe it was Chris, was talking about the high youth unemployment in Greece and Italy and Spain, of course, they do have high youth unemployment, but we are not Greece, Italy and Spain. We are not in the Eurozone. When you look at what's going to happen to the bit that we are in, which is the single market, as I said before, there are plans to complete that single market over the next few years. The key elements of it are what's known as the digital single market, and that's basically creating a single market for the internet. That's very valuable for us, both as consumers. We are more tech-savvy than most European countries, but also as businesses. You know, I have set up two digital businesses. I think Sevenoaks, there's quite a lot of digital businesses in Sevenoaks or around Sevenoaks, having the ability to operate over a very large market without barriers in that industry, which is the industry of the future, very valuable. The man, the second questioner, he asked about finance. What does it mean for finance? Well, what does it mean for being in is another part of that plan is what's known as Capital Markets Union. And Capital Markets Union is essentially making the most of capital markets in Europe. Which is the biggest provider of capital market services in Europe by a long, long way? It's Britain. If that happens, and it will happen if we're part of the EU, that will be a huge wealth creator for the UK financial services industry. And the last thing I want to say is what happens if we come out, as far as finance is concerned. I think I may have mentioned earlier, I'm not sure, the passport. Financial services companies have what's known as a passport that allows them, if they're based in the UK, to offer services right across the EU, based in the UK. No country that doesn't have full access to the single market has that passport. And if we lose that passport, a chunk of our financial services industry will have to relocate across the channel. Now, some people say, oh, well, it'll only be a fraction. This is what Alex Brummer, the city editor of The Mail, said. It's only a fraction. You know, he said in an article a couple of months ago, well, HSBC has said only 20% of its investment banking jobs would go to Paris. And he said that Goldman Sachs says only a third of their investment banking jobs would cross the channel. These are indeed fractions, 20% and a third, but I can tell you they're pretty big fractions, and anyone in that industry will really feel it, and it won't just be felt in that industry, it will be felt in the entire economy, because these are extremely high-paid jobs, and they also account for, if it's 10% of the economy, it's actually about one-eighth of the tax take of the country. So far from having money to spend on farmers and scientists and the NHS, we'll suddenly have to be tightening our belts.
Okay, thanks.
Let me, if I may, run through as quickly as I can the various points. First, the lady asked for the breakdown of the 600 billion euros. That figure came from the commissioner who was in charge of the single market in 2006. And what was especially interesting about it is that in that year, the Commission's own estimate of the benefits of the single market, when they came up with that figure, it was 120 billion euros. So on the Commission's own figures, and if anyone has an interest in talking up the success of the EU as the Commission, the cost of regulation was five times as much as the benefits of easier market penetration because of the single market. They are, admittedly, out-of-date figures, because since that survey, it's not been done again. It was met with such horror by Commission officials, there was such briefing against poor old Verheugen, that no one has since then essayed the task of trying to work out the total cost of the red tape. The point about financial services is the same as the point about the way the world economy is going generally. Something you will almost never hear quoted, but it's true according to the ONS, is that the EU is declining as an export destination for our financial services as for everything else, or almost everything else. According to the ONS, in the last 10 years, if you look at financial services including investments and pensions, the EU has gone from taking 38% of our total exports to taking 33% of our total exports. Last year, the US on its own took 31% of the exports of financial services, including investment and pensions. So what's the price we pay for that? Okay, I'm not saying the 33% of our exports is insignificant, but look at what the long-term future is going to be as we transfer regulatory power to Brussels institutions, which are often malevolent, not just inept, but often explicitly anti-London, which they see as a kind of freebooting, parasitical, lawless place. When you look at the effect of the Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive, the MiFID II rules, the short-selling ban, now the proposed financial transactions tax, there must come a point when you say the cost-benefit analysis here is negative. In exchange for this minority of our export trade, we are having to apply all these deeply
damaging and expensive regulations to the other bits that we don't export to the EU, as well as to the bits that we export to the EU. And that's the same calculation that works for the economy as a whole. And it especially hits the smaller firms. This isn't just a financial services point. I'm guessing that most of you in this room cannot afford full-time teams of lobbyists in Brussels. I mean, from the descriptions of my fellow panellists, they don't sound like the sort of mega-corporations that do that. One of the biggest surprises to me, maybe the biggest surprise when I was a new MEP, was the extent to which these giant multinationals want more regulation. You see, I'd innocently supposed, being elected as a Conservative, that these private companies would want freedom of action. Well, I tell you, that was knocked out of my system within about a week. They love regulation. And it took me a while, but then the penny dropped. The reason they like it is because they can easily afford the compliance costs. And they are raising barriers against any new company challenging their monopoly. And it's because they have invested so many millions over so many years in getting rules that suit them but hurt their rivals that these giant companies and these mega banks, the Goldman Sachs and the JP Morgans and so on, are now bankrolling the Remain campaign. The last thing they want is to have to start all over again with a different set of British regulators. The last thing they want is free and open competition from new startups, from innovators, and from small and medium enterprises. That's why the European Union is falling further and further behind as a share of the world economy. Finally, very quickly, what would be the retaliatory steps, if any? Maybe I'm missing something here. I start from the proposition that people pursue their own self-interest. The EU is selling to us much more than it is buying from us. I saw a lot of hands go up when we were asked, when the audience was asked, how many of you employ people? You know this better than I do, those of you who are in business, in commerce, or in industry or finance, right? Salesmen do not normally go around threatening or bullying their customers. It's not how business works. Right? So I think that the safe assumption we would make is that France and Germany and Portugal and Poland and the other countries would wish to act in their own economic interest by maximizing the cross-channel trade. The only way in which all these arguments about retaliation work is if we assume that these countries would be so vindictive that they would hurt their own economies in order to hurt us more. Now, I don't believe that for a moment. Nothing in the 17 years that I've been working for you in Brussels suggests that that would be their attitude. I think they would be businesslike and friendly, and they would want, as we would want, to retain the closest possible relationship and alliance after we'd left. But if I'm wrong, if Hugo's side is right, if they would be that vindictive, that anti-British, that they'd cut off their nose in order to spite their face, what the hell are we doing inviting them to run our country? If those are the attitudes of the people we're dealing with. Final point, when the gentleman in the middle who asked about what's going to happen next and what's hidden. Well, do you know, never mind what's hidden. Let's just look at what's overt, right? What they're talking about in the Commission, the Five Presidents' Report. They want fiscal union, they want military union, they want political union, they want economic union, they want a European finance ministry, debt pooling, they want harmonisation of social security.
You do admit that that isn't for us, though, don't you?
Well, in the Five Presidents' Report, they say...
fiscal union and that finance ministry is not for us.
They say it will happen through the single market.
You do admit that.
No, I do not admit that.
Well, you haven't read the report properly.
Of course I've read the report. I've read it
three times and you really are distorting it.
Know that it refers to the single market, not only to the 17 or 18 now Eurozone states. But let me put it like this, because, again, we've got this idea that somehow if we stay in, we're staying put. But we're not, right? Imagine that you're on a bus, and at the front of the bus, very clearly marked, is the destination, a United Europe, right? No one's making any bones about this. The bus driver, now that you describe his features under his peaked cap, he bears an uncanny resemblance to Jean-Claude Juncker. The bus driver, just in case anyone misses the point, is telling you what the stops are along the route. Harmonisation of social security,
Harmonisation.
Not for the UK.
Corporation
though.
Tax. Yes. Listen to what Commissioner Tyson is saying.
No, not
about
for
it.
The UK.
Yes. Social union. She's talking about doing it through the legal vehicles of the EU single market because that's the only vehicle available to them at the moment. She's being absolutely clear about that. Yes, it would apply to us and to all the other non-Euro countries. Military harmonisation. Juncker is again being very clear about this. We need a European army, he says, in order to frighten Putin. We wouldn't use it, but it would frighten Putin. Now, I'm no expert on Putin's psychology, but I doubt that he stays awake at night fretting about the prospect of Juncker saying to NATO, hey guys, we'll take this one from here.
Okay.
If you want to stay put, if you're on that bus, what's your status quo option? Is it literally to remain immobile, glued to your seat as the bus purrs along its route, or isn't it to get off the bus, to wave it on its way? In other words, to say to our friends and allies, guys, if this is what you want to do with your common foreign policy, common policing, criminal justice, all that, do it. Fine. Do it with our goodwill and our blessing. But we will not compromise our democracy. We will not bargain with our independence.
All right, thank you, Dan. We got right off the topic of jobs and employability, which is what the topic was on. We're fast running out of time. We're not going to be able to cover all the topics, but of course I want to give you guys the opportunity to respond to that and also just to think about, although we have covered it kind of in some other things, about the general point of regulations, red tape and worker protection. But if someone wants to come back or talk about the things that Dan just said or to make a point to any of the questioners from the Remain side, now's your chance.
So on the financial services point that Dan said about the EU export, that the point's missed there, I think. There are three major trading zones in the world, and that is Japan, the US, and we have got the European financial services, I think you'll agree. The point is that that point is not about how much we trade with the EU. That is irrelevant. The point is that it's the rest we trade with the rest of the world, and eventually that would be removed from our economy because the big financial institutions of the world would want a free trading arrangement within Europe. So probably would move it to Frankfurt over a long period of time, I think, but it wouldn't just collapse. But the City of London, as it is today, as a financial centre, would be quite unrecognisable, in my opinion. And the agriculture point, maybe you'd like to expand on this. The thing about the agriculture point for me on the employment and skills is that it's seasonal. Every day from home, from work, I go down 7 Mile Lane and there's strawberry and fruit farms all over the place. And my partner is a heating and plumbing engineer, and every year about this time he gets involved in setting up accommodation for Eastern Europeans who come. They don't live here all the time. They come and they do seasonal work. The point that Dan made about immigration from other parts of the world is that they wouldn't go back to India or to Australia or New Zealand. But because of the geographical location of Europe and its proximity to us, they come and they pick our strawberries and they do our shearing and then they go home. So I don't know if you have experience of that, but that's my perception of what actually happens in Kent.
Yeah, I don't really employ seasonal labour, but I know a lot of farmers who do employ seasonal labour, and it is very important. I mean, so much won't happen if we don't have these people here. And just to think that somehow we're going to magic them up when we can't get them right now, that's just not going to happen.
Thank you. John or Chris? Chris or John?
It was interesting to say about the retaliatory trade actions and things that happened. Trade actions. I was speaking to one of the BMW dealers, and I was saying, how are you feeling about the EU referendum? Would it affect your business? And in no uncertain terms, he said it won't affect his business at all if we did come out. He was in a particular area where there's a lot of people, he said, want to come out. He said, but as far as he was concerned, that BMW would be pretty crazy to actually put on wider tariffs and do this sort of thing. So retaliatory, I think, I agree totally with Daniel, that it won't happen. We're too big a market for them. Again, let's put ourselves down. We are a big market for the European car manufacturers, and I think retaliatory won't happen. The other thing I think on I went to a breakfast meeting the other day, and there was a guy from a wealth company who was talking from the city, and he said, I'm looking at his investments, people were all asking questions, and they weren't actually investing much in Europe, which was a bit of a worry. Actually, a lot of their investments were not in Europe, and I said, well, it's at this moment in time, it may change, of course, but, you know, Europe isn't quite the place that we want to invest at this moment in time, which is, you know, a pretty, pretty sad indictment of the way Europe is at the moment. So there's just a couple of points that I picked on what we're saying.
Cool. Thanks, John.
Yep.
Chris? Just let Chris go, and then you go. I'm happy to come back to you.
There's some figures released by Revenue Customs about imports and exports, literally February this year. And Germany were importing almost twice as much as we're exporting there. Holland, almost three times as much. More than three times as much from China. And about 50% more than we export to France. Now, it's just common sense that these countries are not going to want us, or not going to want to expel us from doing trade with them, because it's going to hurt them more than it's going to hurt us. So it's a nonsense to say that, you know, all of a sudden we're not going to be able to trade with these countries. It's not. The guy that did the report, this Professor Patrick Milford, that said that we're going to actually be better off on day one, his opinion, because of just losing loads of red tape, is that it has to be Europe coming to us saying, are we all right to do this free trade still? Do you still want to trade with us, rather than the other way around? In terms of finance, London as a financial centre has been going for hundreds of years. Other than the New York Stock Exchange, it's the biggest financial centre going. As I said, it's looking to get together with Germany. I don't know whether that will have a difference, whether we're in or out. But it stands on its own as a financial centre. It's almost like saying that, you know, Obama, or whoever's the president at the time, doesn't have the biggest say in the world of what goes on. He does, because of who they are. And we're the same with our financial centre. Everybody wants to come here. London has more billionaires than anywhere else on the planet. It's just a fantastic place to trade, and it's big enough to stand on its own two feet. It's just this whole change thing that we think if we have change, everything's going to fall apart, and it's just rubbish.
Thank you, Chris.
Hugo, if I can ask you to keep it brief, because we're right up against time.
Just to deal with one of Dan's off-topic issues, the EU army. There's no chance of that happening in anything like the near future, and if the rest of the EU decided they wanted to do that, we could veto it. The only circumstances in which we couldn't veto it would be if we'd left the EU. Chris mentioned Patrick Minford, who indeed is behind this report, the so-called Gang of Eight. He's an extreme free trader. He thinks we should cut all tariffs and open up our markets unilaterally. And a few years ago, he said we shouldn't worry about the prospect of eliminating British manufacturing. So that's what your hero is saying. I'm sure that manufacturers wouldn't be happy with that.
So you are in favour of having tariffs?
I'm not in favour of eliminating British manufacturing.
Are you in favour of having tariffs?
I'm in favour of doing deals that result in the best access for British goods and services that we can. And sometimes that involves imposing tariffs. For example, at the moment, your Conservative Party has been very lax in not agreeing to stiff anti-dumping tariffs against Chinese steel. So yes, sometimes I am, and sometimes I'm not. But what I want to say is about this business of, I think it's very important that the audience realizes the difference between goods and services, and the different ways that that's treated under World Trade Organization rules. And it's true that if we left the EU, it's not very likely that BMW would be prevented from sending their cars to Britain, because under WTO rules, there's a very limited amount of stuff that we could actually do to stop them. But for what matters to us in the services industries, The WTO gives us no protection at all, and the rest of the EU would be quite free to gum up our trade and services. That is a very important asymmetry, which is against our favour if we got into a tough fight with the EU of the sort that Michael Gove wants us to get into.
OK, thanks, Hugo. Thank you, Hugo. Thank you for that. We're kind of right at the end. Sorry. We need to let Dan just respond very quickly to that, and then we're going to kind of wrap it up. But very quickly, if you would.
Well, I mean, I'll just come back to saying I think these are our friends and our allies. And we have no problem with cooperating with them. I think that's common to everyone on the panel. I hope common to everyone in the room. If the European Union were like the WTO or NATO or Commonwealth or APEC or OPEC or any other international organisation, if it simply bound its member states as states, no one would have a problem with it. We wouldn't be having this debate and we wouldn't be having this referendum. You'd have to be insane to be against the idea of working with our immediate neighbours. The problem with it right from the start is that it wasn't about cooperation. It was about political union. It was about taking on the attributes and trappings of government and assuming the functions of statehood and constantly transferring powers from the national states to Brussels level. And so what we want is not an end to cooperation, of course not. We simply want to cooperate with our friends in the same way that every other sovereign democracy on the planet manages its relations. And nowhere else in the world are people expected to apologise for this or to be defensive about it. You know, New Zealand is not about to join Australia. And people don't go around saying, oh, these dreadful Australo-sceptics, when are they going to understand that they're just a small offshore island trapped in their 19th century sense of sovereignty? You know, Japan, as far as I'm aware, is not going to join China. And people don't say, oh, these bigoted Sino-sceptics, you know, when are they going to understand that they've lost their empire? It is a natural, healthy thing for a democracy to live under its own laws while trading and cooperating with its friends and allies on every other continent. If you want the full case for this, by the way, available outside is my book, Why Vote Leave?
And his
book is also available, so they will both be available.
Only £5.
You'll both be able to sign them for anyone who would like. If you're planning to vote Leave, if I've convinced you, great. If not, nothing much happening in June. Have a nice holiday.
We've instantly improved the GDP of the country. Thanks. But buying books. Thank you very much. We've kind of reached the end of that. I'd like to do the reverse of what we did at the start. I'd like, by a show of hands, to see those people that are still undecided about whether to remain or to leave. A few.
Could you ask how many people changed their minds?
I'm going to do that.
Okay, very good.
Thank you, Hugo. How many people have changed their mind as a result of tonight? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. A few still trying to decide whether to change. Okay. How many people, therefore, are intent on voting to remain in the European Union? Okay. And those intending to vote to leave? I would say, keep your hands up, marginally more, just very marginally more. Not a huge amount more, but just slightly. Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to say a massive thank you to quite a few people. First and foremost, of course, to our panel, to Hugo, Tina, Tobin, Daniel, John and Chris. I would also like to say a massive thank you to you, the audience. You were incredibly well behaved. No question time shenanigans here. And I thank you very much for that, because it was difficult. We didn't have the equipment to kind of handle a full-scale debate in the audience. So I do appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. I'd also like to say a massive, massive thank you to Mark, Andrea, Caroline, Julie, Kirstein and all the team from the Seven Oaks Chamber of Commerce for staging this debate tonight. Come on, yes. And certainly last but not least to Seven Oaks School and the space for providing this wonderful venue. We will see what we can do with the transcripts of this that we recorded, and we hope to broadcast it. We will let you all know. You can certainly see on Twitter, and we will try to let people know when it's going to be broadcast. For the moment, thank you very much for coming. Thank you for joining us in the Seven Oaks Chamber debate, and we wish you all a safe journey home. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.